I'm gonna close the curtain behind me because the light is bugging me. All right. So, we are at the beginning of chapter 9. And the first chunk of chapter 9 is all about Paul. You're surprised, right, that Paul takes a good chunk of some of his writings to talk about himself. Because that's not like him at all.
Not at all.
She says, being very facetious. And as we read more of Paul's writing, this is a style that you will become familiar with.
Dude takes a paragraph to say hello.
Liz says, dude takes a paragraph to say hello. So, which is true. And also, there is nothing he likes more than talking about himself. So, this chunk of Paul is the first 23 verses of chapter 9. So, settle in and I will read to you. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are you not my work in the Lord? If I am not an apostle to others, at least I am to you, for you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. This is my defense to those who would examine me. Do we not have the right to our food and drink? Do we not have the right to be accompanied by a believing wife, as do other apostles, and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working for a living? Who at any time pays the expenses for doing military service? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat any of its fruit? Or who tends a flock and does not get any of its milk? Do I say this on human authority? Does not the law also say the same? For it is written in the law of Moses, "You shall not muzzle an ox while it is treading out the grain." Is it for the oxen that God is concerned, or does he not speak entirely for our sake? It was indeed written for our sake. For whoever plows should plow in hope, and whoever threshes should thresh in hope of the share of the crop. If we have sown spiritual good among you, is it too much if we reap your material benefits? If others share this rightful claim on you, do we not still more? Nevertheless, we have not made use of this right, but we endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that those who are employed in the temple service get their food from the temple, and those who serve at the altar share in what is sacrificed on the altar? In the same way, the Lord commanded that those who proclaim the gospel should get their living by the gospel. But I have made no use of any of these rights. Nor am I writing this so that they may be applied in my case. Indeed, I would rather die than that. No one will deprive me of my ground for boasting. If I proclaim the gospel, this gives me no ground for boasting, for an obligation is laid on me. And woe to me if I do not proclaim the gospel. For if I do this of my own will, I have a reward. But if not of my own will, I am entrusted with a commission. What then is my reward? Just this, that in my proclamation I may make the gospel free of charge, so as not to make full use of my rights in the gospel. For though I am free with respect to all, I have made myself a slave to all, so that I might win more of them. To the Jews I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, although I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law, so that I might win those outside the law. To the weak, I became weak, so that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that I might by all means save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, so that I may share in its blessings. So the first thing to say about that is that passive-aggressive is not something that we invented in the 20th century. There's Paul. there are two things going on here. The first is that Paul is making a claim for himself to be supported in his ministry by the Corinthians, and he's doing it in a very passive-aggressive way by saying that, you know, I'm not asking for myself, but of course it's my right to be supported by you in my ministry. But I'm not asking for myself. I'm just pointing out that I have the right to ask it of you. So that's what the vast majority of that is about, is, hey, y'all, you should be sending me some money. Yeah. Is what most of that is about. The important bit for us is the last bit, where he says, I have become all things to all people that I might by all means save some. Right? To a Jew I became as a Jew to win the Jews. To those outside the law I became as one outside the law. To the Greeks I became as a Greek. You know, he's saying, I speak to people where they are. And the caveat of that is, and you should do that too. Meet people where they are so that they can hear you. Go ahead.
When you're done, I have a question.
I'm done.
Okay, on verse 15, 16 in there where he talks about boasting.
Yes.
He says, but I have made no use of any of these rights, nor am I writing this so that they may be applied in my case. Indeed, in this next sentence.
Yes.
I would rather die than that. No one will deprive me of my ground for boasting. I don't understand that sentence.
What he's saying is, so he's laying out that I have the right to be supported by you in my ministry. And then, but I'm not asking you to. Indeed, it's the last thing I would want. So read it with kind of a dramatic, you know. But no, it's not really for me. And when he says no one will deprive me of my ground for boasting, what he's saying is, I'm doing this for free. So I can, you know, pride myself on that. And if you paid me, I wouldn't be able to. That's all part of that. If I'm being mean, I call it passive aggressive. And if I'm being more polite, I call it reverse psychology of, no, I don't want you to support me. That's the last thing I would want.
Okay. I have a question. It's a little to me like he's trying to convince himself sometimes.
I think maybe some of that. Yes. Go ahead, Jeanette.
Going on in that same paragraph, verse 17, for if I do this of my own will, I have a reward. If not of my own will, I am trusted
with a commission.
I don't understand what he's trying to get across there.
What he's trying to get across there...
Or is he supposed to do it entrusted with a commission? Which one is he supposed to be doing?
Both. He's making both arguments. What he's saying is, if I do this because I choose to, so I get a reward for that, but I'm also commissioned by God to do this, and so I really have to do it, even if I didn't want to.
Okay. I thought it was an if-or thing.
It's phrased as an if-or thing, but it's actually, and that's a function of, style of Greek argument, where you make it look like it's an if or, but it's actually a both and.
Okay.
That's actually, if you read other Greek rhetoric of the time, you see a lot of that type of.
I think it's interesting that he's so sure of what God wants him to do.
Oh yes.
I know that, when we pray that, show us the way is that you want us to go or what you want us to do, and we will do our best to do it.
Right.
But we still don't always know what God is showing us. He doesn't seem to have any doubts. God wants me to be everything to everybody.
Yep.
And that sounds to me, when you're trying to be everything to everybody, you can't do that.
Right.
You have to be yourself, and you're one person. You can't be everything to everybody.
Yeah, and we actually say that a lot. You can't be all things to all people. And Paul is saying the reverse. His point, though, is that, and this is something I think that is a really good lesson for the church today, that we need to meet the people we're trying to reach where they are, not where we want them to be. Right? And that's the point of this, is, and the good example is the under the law one. So I'm not making the people who haven't been following the Jewish law follow the Jewish law first. I'm meeting them where they are and telling them about Jesus. I'm meeting the Jews where they are and telling them about Jesus. I am, to the people who are weak in faith, I'm meeting them where they are. Right? So that's the point of this, is the people you're trying to reach with the gospel, don't put prerequisites on it. Don't make them become something else before you tell them that God loves them. Right?
Unless it involves eating of meat, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, and remember, his lesson about the eating of meat isn't for the people they're trying to reach. It's for the people who are already reached to pay attention to the needs of those who they are trying to reach. Once you become a Christian and a follower of Christ and a deeper follower of Christ, then part of loving your neighbor as yourself is not doing things that cause other people to fall. So that lesson is for the insiders, if you will, for the already believing Christians as part of their formation as Christians. The lesson of meeting people where they are and not requiring anything of them to hear the message of Christ is for those who haven't heard the message of Christ and accepted it yet.
Well, the message to me is give him more benefit of the doubt.
Yes. Although not always, because Paul is obnoxious. I mean, if you haven't gotten that yet, he's obnoxious. He's not a nice person. He probably wouldn't have been all that fun to hang out with, and you wouldn't have wanted him as your pastor. But he's doing his thing.
What do you think his message? I'm thinking of the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
The reasons for being excommunicated, the reasons mm-hmm. that you're not welcome, you know, whether you're gay or you're divorced. Mm-hmm. I don't know. All the different things they put on that. Is this a lesson then, kind of like as a church, like being more accepting?
Yes. Paul would have said, what do you think you're doing? Why are you putting blocks in the way of people coming to Christ?
Because the church is supposed to be inclusive.
The church is supposed to be inclusive. And then the hope, Paul's hope and expectation is that as you draw closer to Christ, you live a more and more Christ-like life. But the Christ-like life is the fruit of the faith, not the requirements to join the faith. Right? So
the only commandment we have is love God and love your neighbor. So.
Right. Love God and love your neighbor. And as you do that, as you pray regularly, as you draw yourself closer to God, as you consider others more and more, you become more and more like Christ. But again, that's the outcome, not the input.
Yeah. So your behavior and actions will be, like you said, the outcome.
Right. We call it in the church formation, and we do it for a reason. Think about like a clay, if you've ever worked with clay, even in school. You know, you start with a lump of clay that doesn't look like much, and as you work on it, it becomes something. Right?
Hopefully something beautiful.
Hopefully something beautiful, but something, you know, something different. That's what the Christian life is. And it's the difference between belief and what we call in the church sanctification, which is a very fancy way of saying becoming more like Christ. The goal of living being as a Christian is sanctification. But you don't have to be sanctified to be a Christian. Right? Does that make sense? And Paul, in this letter and in almost all of his letters, flips back and forth from talking to the church about how they should proclaim the gospel to others, and talking to the church about how they should form themselves, how they should live. And he doesn't always note clearly when he's changing what he's talking about. So we'll find that a lot, where he jumps from, like chapter 8 in 1 Corinthians, he's talking to them about being careful of their behavior in regards to meat in the marketplace so that they don't cause other people to fall, and then flips pretty quickly to meet people where they are, don't let this stuff get in the way. Okay?
Going back for a moment to what Paul would be like to associate with, mm-hmm. I think that his enthusiasm, I think, would be very attractive. You know, his energy and enthusiasm mm-hmm. for the gospel, I think, would be attract people to him.
And it did. What's really clear is that he's one of those people who is really charismatic and draws people to him right away, but it's kind of tough to live with long term.
A little freaky.
A little bit. And a little, he falls into feeling sorry for himself. Quite a lot. Which is hard to be around. All right, so let's see, where am I going? All right, I'm going to pick up with... Where am I on time? I'm going to pick up with verse 24. And I'm going through verse 22 of chapter 10. And I'm looking ahead a little bit. All right, just looking ahead a little bit. All right, so picking up with verse 24 of chapter 9. Do you not know that in a race the runners all compete, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win it. Athletes exercise self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable one. So I do not run aimlessly, nor do I box as though beating the air. But I punish my body and enslave it, so that after proclaiming to others, I myself should not be disqualified. I'm actually going to stop there for a minute. So he's talking here about formation, about that formation thing we were talking about, that we're running a race and we need to be ready for it, right? And he uses the image of an athlete, you know. If you're going to run in a race, you prepare for it. You don't just get up in the morning and say, I'm going to run a race. And you run with a direction. You don't just randomly run around. You run in the course that's set before you. So he's talking about that formation thing here. That we have a task set for us. We need to be ready for it. So. Okay. All right, picking up then with verse 1 of chapter 10. I do not want you to be unaware, brothers and sisters, that our ancestors were all under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in a cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, God was not pleased with most of them, and they were struck down in the wilderness. Now these things occurred as examples for us, so that we did not desire evil as they did. Do not become idolaters as some of them did. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink, and they rose up to play. We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ to the test, as some of them did, and were destroyed by serpents. And do not complain, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. These things happened to them to serve as an example, and they were written down to instruct us on whom the ends of the ages have come. So if you think you are standing, watch out that you do not fall. No testing has overtaken you that is not common to everyone. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tested beyond your strength. But with the testing, he will also provide the way out, so that you may be able to endure it. I'm going to stop there. What he is referencing back to is the journey of the people of Israel from Egypt to the Promised Land. Okay, and so he's making little references to that story. The cloud and the sea, or the pillar of cloud that led the Israelites through the wilderness. The pillar of cloud by day, the pillar of fire by night. The sea is obviously the Red Sea being parted for them. The other things he's referring to there are things that happened to them in the course of that journey. So the spiritual food he's talking about is the manna that came down from heaven to feed them. The water is where Moses struck the rock with his sword, with his staff, and water came out. He's talking about the sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. He's talking about the golden calf that they made an idol and danced around. And then where he says, don't complain as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents, where a bunch of them were complaining about Moses and God sent serpents to bite them, and then Moses put a serpent on his staff and held it up, and anyone who looked at it was healed because he repented. The destroyed by the destroyer is talking about where they were complaining about not having meat or cucumbers or melons like they had in Egypt, and God sent them so many quail that they ate and were sick, and a lot of them died. So all of these are references to bits of that story of them wandering around in the wilderness. Paul is casting himself in this thing as Moses, dealing with the unruly people of Israel who were complaining all the time and didn't listen to him. So there's a little bit of that. Just like Moses, I have to deal with you people who aren't listening to God. And if you remember reading bits of the Exodus, Moses spends a lot of time complaining to God about the people of Israel. And as a matter of fact, there's an ongoing conversation between God and Moses about the people of Israel that goes something like this. Moses comes to God and says, Lord, these people you gave me, I can't deal with them anymore, get rid of them. And God says to Moses, now, it will be okay, don't worry. And then a little later in the story, God says to Moses, these people, the people you lead, I can't deal with them, I'm just going to wipe them out. And Moses says, now, you don't want to do that, because if you do that, all the other nations will talk badly about you. It'll be okay, I promise. And they go back and forth like that, taking turns complaining about the people of Israel and their behavior. So this is not a flattering thing for the Corinthians that they get cast as the people of Israel in this part of the story. And Paul is kind of saying to them, now don't be like that. Stop your moaning. Stop complaining, because you know what happened. God's patience is not infinite. No.
Can I ask a question on one
sure.
phrase? At the end of verse 5, nevertheless, God was not pleased with Moses, and they were struck down in the wilderness. What was that?
Remember that the reason they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years was so that all of them who stood at the edge of the Jordan and were afraid to go in because they didn't trust God had died. So that's what that's talking about.
He didn't to the Promised Land.
That's right. The only ones who left Egypt who got into the Promised Land was Joshua and the few people who, with him, believed that God could give them the Promised Land. The rest of them died wandering around in the wilderness for 40 years. Because they didn't believe. So, okay, other questions about that?
So, if we want to look at Exodus to understand this, is it the whole book of Exodus or what?
This comes from lots of different chunks of it, but start with chapter... if you read like from chapter 13 through about chapter 17 or 18, you'll get most of the story.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. They had to wait for Moses to die, besides, didn't they? Because he...
Yes, because that rock we were talking about where he struck it with his staff, God told him to speak to the rock. And he didn't. He lifted up his staff and hit it. And God said...
Killed somebody.
No.
Why he couldn't go in?
No. The killing somebody isn't why he couldn't go in. He killed an Egyptian before he left Egypt. But the reason he couldn't enter the Promised Land was because he disobeyed God. He used God's power in a way that God had not instructed him to. God didn't seem very worried about killing people back then.
I was thinking about this Paul thing, though. And maybe some of this is so that we are reminded that Paul is a human being.
Yes.
And he is not God.
That's right.
You shouldn't expect him to be God, either.
Well, and it is in line with God's whole history with human beings. God almost never chooses perfect people.
And are there any?
And he doesn't even always choose good people. The people God chooses have pretty clear flaws. And sometimes, yes. So, you know, and if you think about it, just list the characters. If you think about Jacob and David and Solomon and... Abraham, all of the people God chooses mostly have pretty major character flaws. And he uses them anyway. What's interesting is, maybe it's because we know less about the women God chooses seems to have fewer character flaws.
And rightly so.
Yes. All right, so I'm picking up at verse 14. Of chapter 10. Therefore, my dear friends, flee from the worship of idols. I speak as to sensible people. Judge for yourselves what I say. The cup of blessing that we bless, is it not a sharing of the blood of Christ? The bread that we break, is it not a sharing in the body of Christ? Because there is one bread, we who are many are one body, for we all partake the one bread. Consider the people of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifice partners in the altar? What do I imply then? That food sacrificed to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything? No, I imply that what pagans sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. I do not want you to be partners with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Or are you provoking the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he? So he flips back to that idol thing. And what he's doing is taking the communion meal, the cup and the bread that they break, and saying, we are one body because we share in the body of Christ. Don't share then with those things that are offered to idols. This is the earliest written reference to communion. Because it's one of the earliest books, but it's one of the earliest written references to communion. So by the mid-50s, when Paul is writing this letter, sharing bread and sharing a cup and calling it the body and blood of Christ is something that is being done and being done regularly enough that he knows that they will understand what he's talking about. Right? He can just throw away in his letter the reference to...
That started from the Last Supper? Correct?
Yes. Yes. So this is evidence that that has become something that is regularly done in the church. We don't know if it's done every week, but we know that it's done often enough that he expects that the people will understand what he's referring to. So,
okay. Just a general question about the letters in general.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't these awfully long for him to send to some people and hope that they're going to read and comprehend all of it?
Well, they are long, but letters at the time were long. Because it's very expensive to send a letter. You have to find somebody to transport it for you. And also, remember, people had much longer attention spans back then because there was less input, right? Probably what would have happened is that he wrote this to someone he knew could read, and that person would read it out to the group, and probably they would read it over and over and over again.
And he didn't do this very often.
He didn't do this very often.
Yeah, so he had a lot to say.
and he wrote it with the intention that it would be read out over and over again and discussed.
Right, because there's a lot in there.
There is a lot in there.
If you just read it once, you're not going to get it. Really.
Right. Letters at that time were very rare. So it's not like at our time where you would get mail every day. Right? You might get a letter twice in your lifetime if you could read. So they were big deals.
For time, too, right? He probably didn't just sit down and write the whole thing.
No, he would have written this over probably over several months. And he's responding to lots of things he's heard about from them. You know, people have come to Ephesus, where he probably is when he's writing this, and said, "We're having this problem in the Corinthian church. We're having that problem in the Corinthian church." And he's even sent some messengers back to them with verbal messages. So this is kind of a compilation of, you all obviously need some more teaching. I can't get back there, so I'm sending you a letter. All right. So I pick it up at verse 23. And I'm going to go through verse 1 of chapter 11, which is where that chunk ends. And that's where we'll stop for today. All things are lawful, but not all things are beneficial. All things are lawful, but not all things build up. Do not seek your own advantage, but that of the others. Eat whatever is sold in the meat market without raising any question on the ground of conscience, for the earth and its fullness are the Lord. If an unbeliever invites you to a meal and you are disposed to go, eat whatever is set before you without raising any question on the ground of conscience. But if someone says to you, "This has been offered in sacrifice," then do not eat it, out of consideration for the one who informed you and for the sake of conscience. I mean the other's conscience, not your own. For why should my liberty be subject to the judgment of someone else's conscience? If I partake with thankfulness, why should I be denounced because of that for which I give thanks? So whether you eat or drink, or whatever you do, do everything for the glory of God. Give no offense to Jews or to Greeks or to the Church of God, just as I try to please everyone in everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, but that of many, so that they may be saved. Be imitators of me, as I am of Christ. So his point here goes back to the don't create offense for people that keeps them from hearing about Christ. So when he says, if you're invited to the home of an unbeliever, eat whatever's put before you. Don't, you know, don't make demands of your host. Just eat whatever they give you, because he knows that, you know, and you know how it is. If someone comes to your house for dinner and then cross-questions you about whether the fish is wild-caught and, you know, is the chicken free-range, how you feel.
Right.
It's the same thing here. Don't put those stumbling blocks above people being able to hear your message. But if someone goes out of their way to tell you it's been sacrificed to an idol, then think about what they're trying to do. Yeah. And say,
so
well,
the sacrifice is always to another religion.
Right.
Is that right?
That's right. The only place the Jews sacrificed meat to God was in the Jerusalem temple. And meat that was sacrificed in the temple under Jewish law was kept for the priests. There was no such thing as meat sacrifice to the God of Israel that was available for anybody outside the priest and the Levites. So,
how many of us would be willing or able to say, be an imitator of me?
As I am of Christ, yes.
You know, I think that's a big deal.
Yes. No. And he goes on to say, as I am of Christ, you know, I imitate Christ, but you can imitate me. Yes. That's, you know, one of the things that you promise as a priest, one of the ordination vows, is that you will strive to be a wholesome example to those whom you serve. So, and you also you also promise to pattern your life after the teachings of Christ. So, and it comes from this idea that people who will watch you, and what they see you doing, they assume is okay, right? It's why I don't have a Christian symbol on my car, because I'm not a good witness when I drive.
Paul, I mean, it seems when you're reading this, there's just so many rules.
Yes.
So many. But I wonder if it's more in response to people's questions. And I think to myself, why are people so worried about how they're behaving and what they're doing? It doesn't seem like he's really giving the lessons of Christ. Like, he's not, like, talking about how Christ lived.
Right.
This is how you treat people. These are, like, these minute little...
Yes. And this is in response to what the Corinthians are writing. And it's a huge deal for them. In Judaism, there are tons of laws about what you can eat, what you can't eat, how you have to prepare what you can eat, what you can eat together, right? Lots of the Jewish laws are about food. So you have that of the people who come from a Jewish background or who know anything about Judaism is, well, how many of those laws do we have to follow? And then you have the cultural context of... We're not in an agrarian village where we can just go out into the fields and pick stuff. We have to buy our food. Every single marketplace is under the protection of one of these idols. What do we do about the meat that's been offered to them that's now for sale? Can we eat that? Is that dishonoring God? There is, at this time, as far as I can remember, I could be wrong about this, but as far as I can remember, at this time, there is no religion, there is no God that doesn't demand some kind of food sacrifice. And so this Jesus who says, I'm the sacrifice you don't need to make anymore, is weird. So how do we follow Jesus if we don't have to make sacrifices? And if we're not making sacrifices to Jesus, then what do we do with all the other sacrifice stuff to the other gods? And so we don't sacrifice to Jesus? How does that work? So that's all still...
People like rules, though. It's easier when you have rules, mm-hmm. then you can follow them. and know you're doing the right thing, and it makes life easier. So, it, like children,
yes,
they're comfortable when they know the rules.
Well, and if you look at Christian history, what the church has done for 2,000 years is taken Jesus' very basic teachings, love God and love your neighbor, and written rules about how you should do that. Right? So that's because we're human and we like rules. And not having rules is tough. Not only how do I know that I'm doing it right, but how do I know that you're doing it right? Because I'm pretty sure I'm doing it right, but what if you're not? So,
discourage that either. I mean, he's not discouraging that attention to these minute things. He's not really teaching the message of Christ as much as
how to live. Yeah.
Conduct themselves as a Christian.
How to conduct themselves as a Christian is a very good way to put it. Is in the place where you find yourself, what does it mean to live as a Christian? That's really the question he's answering in this, as much as what is it that Jesus taught is, so where you find yourself, Corinthians, what does it mean to live as a Christian? And as we go through his writings, a lot of them are taken up with, so what does it mean, Colossians, for how do you live in Colossae as a Christian? What does it mean, Thessalonians, for how you live in Thessalonica as a Christian? What does it mean, you know, what does it mean, Romans, for how you live in Rome as a Christian? So, and that's, if you think about the context, that makes a lot of sense, because this is really new, and nobody really knows the answer of what does it mean to live as a Christian. And as the church gets more and more separated from the synagogue, there are fewer answers for what does it mean to live as a follower of God. And so we need to come up with our own answers, particularly as time goes on and it becomes clearer and clearer that, well, maybe Jesus isn't coming back next week. You know, these things that weren't a big deal if Jesus is coming back tomorrow or this month become a bigger deal as you begin to suspect that, well, maybe not this week. Right? And we'll see that too as we go through chronologically.
On a small scale, it even goes back to Jesus healing somebody
on the Sabbath. Yes. Yeah, Jesus got in trouble for breaking the rules all the time. Jesus was all about the rule, and Jesus never says the rules aren't important. As a matter of fact, he says the opposite. He says not a jot or a tittle will be removed from this law until it is fulfilled. But he is always going back to the spirit of the law is more important than the letter of the law. So you heal on the Sabbath because the Sabbath is created for people. And the spirit of the law is to create something that is of assistance to people. So if you're walking through the garden, you're through the fields on the Sabbath and you pick up some wheat, that's not doing work. That's fulfilling the purpose of the Sabbath in a different way. So, and you can see Paul trying to do that. You know, don't worry about it. Unless there's a reason to worry about it, then worry about it. So really his lesson about this food thing, which I'm sure, you know, is a big thing he gets asked at, is you don't have to worry about it unless worrying about it or not worrying about it causes somebody else not to be able to hear the message of Christ. Then worry about it. Right? So his point is you don't worry about it for yourself. If you're just doing your thing, it doesn't matter because these idols aren't real. But if what you're doing or not doing is causing problems for someone you need to proclaim the message of Christ to, then that's what you need to be concerned about. So it's not that you should never eat meat offered to idols or you should always eat meat offered to idols. It's that what is your action doing to impact the people around you? which is a bit of Jesus's love your neighbor as yourself, right? Think about what your actions are doing to those who are around you.
So you could even do two things that were opposite in their nature at different times, depending on who you're doing it with or for.
Yes, and that's actually what he says, is eat the meat if you're at a non-believer's house, unless it becomes a big deal for them, and then don't. That it's not the behavior itself that's important, it's how it's impacting those around you.
So, is that what he's talking about right before verse 29? It says, don't eat the meat that's been sacrificed out of consideration for the one who informed you and for the sake of conscience. I mean, the other's conscience, not your own.
Not your own.
Why should my liberty be subject to the judgment of someone else's conscience? I don't understand that part.
So what he's saying is, this eating meat thing is not important for me. It doesn't trouble my conscience, and it shouldn't trouble yours either way. Right? Whether you eat the meat offered to idols or don't, God doesn't care, is what he's saying, and you shouldn't either. The only reason it's important is if it impacts the people around you who you're trying to reach for the gospel. So if someone tells you this meat has been offered to idols and you eat it, then their conscience says, well, they must think this idol is also God because they eat meat offered to them. So for the sake of their conscience, don't eat it. But if you just go to somebody's house and they put a meal in front of you, don't cross-question them, because if it's not important to them, it's not important to you. Okay? The point isn't whether you should or shouldn't eat the meat. When he says all things are lawful to me, that's what he's saying. As a Christian, God doesn't care whether you eat meat offered to idols or not. It has no impact on your salvation. The only reason it matters is if it gets in the way of someone else. If someone else watching you eat meat offered to idols causes them a problem, then take their conscience into account and behave with love towards them. Not because you have to, but because you should want to.
And why does he use my liberty there?
Well, what he's talking about is he's talking about liberty from the law, right? I'm not bound by the law. I'm free from the law. But I don't exercise my liberty where it will harm others.
Oh, okay, okay.
Okay?
Yes, that makes it clearer, thank you.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And we're gonna see this dilemma a lot as we read Paul and the Pauline letters, of God doesn't care about this, but the people watching us do, so we're gonna behave this way. Right? That's gonna come up all the time. So, and it's going to be different things in different letters because of different contexts. For the Corinthians, it's food.
That's important for us also.
Yes.
To do likewise.
Yes. Okay, I think that's a good place to stop. We'll pick up with chapter 11, verse 2 next week. And yeah, we won't finish the book next week, but we're getting close to the end. So, there's light at the end of the tunnel of Corinthians. All right.
I have one more quick question. You mentioned how God chose in the Old Testament people.
Yes.
You know, like David and so forth, mm-hmm. that have flaws. You know, mm-hmm. that they're not the most. Anyway, it's interesting that also Jesus.
Yes.
Choosing of his followers. I mean, he did not choose the upper class, you know, but instead it was the sinners, the low lowly sinners.
Yep, and not the sharpest knives in the drawer. I mean, especially if you read about Peter, Peter never gets it. I mean, as a group, the disciples don't get it, but Peter particularly, man, there had to be somebody smarter than Peter out there. But Jesus picked Peter, not in spite of the fact that he's a little dim, but I think because of the fact that he's a little dim. You know, I think that's part of that.
He believed in all these people's potential.
That's right. That's right.
Peter's the rock, right?
Yeah, Peter's the rock on which the church was built. And, yeah, read the Gospels and pay attention to Peter. Peter is stupid sometimes. He gets it right a couple of times, and usually right after he gets it right, he gets it wrong. So he's, you know, which makes him very lovable and approachable.
And human.
And human. Human. And human. Yeah. So.
They wonder where you fit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. So the good news is if God can use Peter, God can use us.
Yeah.
All right. On that note, I will see you all next week.
Next Tuesday.
Thank
you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. Next Tuesday for book club and next Wednesday for Bible study.
Yep. Bye-bye. Bye.